Well, ethnomusicology is the study of music. Now, that would be the term musicology, but the ethno part means in relation to culture. You can study music in relation to the culture that it comes from, and then, of course, you can do what's called comparative musicology. That, in fact, was the old term for ethnomusicology, and it's the relationship of different cultural musical systems to one another.
So I understand through your research that you found census records that could indicate a possible birthday or at least birth year of Sonny Boy Williamson. And this is, you know, kind of before those records were widely available. How did you come across that?
Well, a fellow named Bill Donahue, who was doing research on Sonny Boy Williamson, number two, that is Alec Miller, he asked me to do this research, actually paid me to do it. I forget where he was, I think Washington State or somewhere like that. And at that time, I think this was back in the 90s, you had to go to the state, pretty much to the state where the census was taken. Sonny Boy Williamson was from Mississippi. A lot of people think he was from Arkansas because he broadcast on the radio out of Helena, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually from the Mississippi Delta. And so I was based in Memphis, and even the Memphis libraries did not have the Mississippi census. So I had to go across the state line to Hernando, Mississippi, and somehow got their library to acquire microfilms of the census, and I had to look at it there on a microfilm reader, and I found his family. I can't remember the details, but they were down in the Delta, near Greenwood. Was able to show that, through the census record, that he was a lot younger than many people thought he was. Apparently, he increased his age at some point in his life, perhaps to draw Social Security, or avoid the draft, or just didn't know, or just wanted to make himself appear older for whatever reason.
So when I was first like getting into the blues, I mean, you always hear these stories about musicians selling their soul to the devil, and you know, I always thought when I first got into it, it was Robert Johnson who sold his soul to the devil, but I understand it was actually Tommy Johnson, no relation there, who allegedly had said that. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, Robert Johnson, there are some reports. They're kind of vague, and they may be the product of people putting words in informants' mouths, you know, about his deal with the devil. But Tommy Johnson's report, though, comes not out of his songs. There's nothing in his songs that suggests any kind of concern about a diabolical relationship. But his brother, who's a sanctified preacher, his older brother, Liddell Johnson, claimed to me, and Tommy said, told Liddell that he had made a pact with the devil at a crossroads at midnight, and the devil took his guitar and tuned it or played a tune on it and handed it back to him, and from that point on, Tommy could play anything he wanted to play.
Wow. So I know you've done quite a bit of research on Tommy Johnson. What was it kind of about his style that was so unique to the time?
Well, I was interested in him for a number of reasons. I guess primarily I really liked his recordings. But I noticed early on in the mid-60s, maybe by about 1964 or so, that his songs, that he recorded versions of them, were turning up in the playing of a lot of other musicians on record, people like Casey Douglas, Shirley Griffith, and then Robert Nighthawk, and I kept hearing, you know, versions of songs like Big Road Blues and Cool Drink of Water Blues, and then I met a musician, Babe Stovall, who played a couple of Tommy's songs, and from there he led me to other musicians that were influenced by Tommy Johnson, and it was just a network. I found it interesting, you know, as a way to understand how blues were learned and created, how it was a kind of oral tradition.
So I know we were talking a little bit about Sonny Boy earlier, and a lot of blues musicians of that time period kind of have inconsistent backstories or just things about them that we don't really know. And I know Charlie Patton has a lot of mystery surrounding him, particularly his race. And you did a really interesting breakdown of some of his lyrics in the book Charlie Patton, Voice of the Mississippi Delta.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit what went into that, and then kind of where did that lean your opinion on his race?
Well, one of the problems in historical blues research, especially in trying to reconstruct the life and musical career of someone who's deceased, you know, can't be interviewed and never was interviewed, is that so-called facts about them are often obtained from fellow musicians that maybe just knew the artist briefly and only in a musical context, playing gigs with them, which were often pretty chaotic affairs, and people were drinking a lot and all that. So that's different from getting information, say, from family members.
Sure.
And or people that knew them over a long term. So I tried to do both through doing field work. You could go to people's hometowns and talk to, like, Tommy Johnson's older brother, you know, that was able to tell about him from his birth on up. Of course, he had his own highly religious perspective on it. That's where that devil story came from. But getting back, I did the same with Charlie Patton. Talked to one of his sisters and nephew, and you get a different perspective on him. His niece told me the most. His ancestry was mixed, and that's fairly obvious just in looking at the pictures of him. Black or African on one side through his father's mother and also through his mother. I and some colleagues of mine have been able to trace his ancestry back to his great-grandparents.
Wow.
Including a great-grandmother. His father's father was, we're about 99% sure, was a white man named W.D. Patton that was an overseer on the plantation where his grandmother was a slave. And then on his mother's side, there were some allegations of Indian ancestry, Native American ancestry, but that can't be proved. And granddaughter of Charlie's brother did a DNA test and found no Indian ancestry.
Hmm.
So it just remains a kind of family tradition, kind of like Senator Elizabeth Warren. You know?
Right.
With her family tradition, you might say. People said that Charlie looked like a Mexican, whatever that's supposed to mean, but it suggests, you know, somebody of mixed ancestry. And Charlie seemed to be conscious of this. There are intimations in his songs of a kind of sense of ambivalence and not wanting to fit into or not accepting the rigid racial dichotomy of the Mississippi Delta of his day, you know, where you were, if you had any African ancestry, you were black or Negro or whatever term was used. Charlie seemed to be conscious of this inconsistency, you know, in his past. That's not to say that he wanted to be white. There's no evidence of that, but I think he wanted his own place in the world. He just, you know, like Martin Luther King.
Right.
He was judged on the content of his character. He was quite a character, too. And he did it, basically. You know, he stayed in the Delta. He lived in the Delta, died in the Delta, you know, at an age of, well, he was in his early 50s. led a very full life.
Yeah, yeah, for the time, absolutely.
You can imagine, you know, the life that he led as a pretty much professional musician compared to a lot of people who led very predictable lives and didn't go much of anywhere. And, Charlie probably led 1,000 lives in one lifetime. Every day, every week, was kind of an adventure.
And I know Charlie Patton recorded with, and I know he was friends with one of my favorites, Son House. So can you give me some insight into their relationship and then how you met Son House?
Well, their relationship, Charlie Patton moved to Beulah, Mississippi. Son House was from Clarksdale and had gone up to Beulah and was courting a girlfriend there and ran into Charlie Patton, and Charlie liked Son's music, I guess, and invited him to come along on his next recording session. They did, and then Son House occasionally played with Charlie over the next few years in the Delta, but at some point Charlie and his last wife, Bertha Lee, they moved southward in the Delta down to Holly Ridge near Greenville, and Son House didn't see him very much until one time a few months before Charlie died, maybe around the beginning of 1934 or end of 1933. How I knew Son, he was rediscovered. A friend of mine, Al Wilson, and I were interviewing Booker White, who had just been rediscovered, and we asked about other singers that we knew of, names, people that had recorded, and we asked about Son House. And Booker said that a friend of his had seen Son House the year before in Memphis, and so we told that to some friends of ours, Phil Spiro, and he told Dick Waterman, and the two of them got together with Nick Pearls and made an expedition to follow up this lead.
I mean, why not, though? If you have a chance, you can meet him. Why not?
A friend of this guy had seen, Booker White had seen Son House coming out of a theater. So, that report turned out to be a red herring, but they did pick up a trail of Son House and found some relatives in Mississippi. It turned out Son House had moved to Rochester, New York, way back in the 1940s, and they got an address and phone number and went to Rochester, called him up, went to Rochester and found him, and then he started doing concerts. One of his first tours was they brought him back to Cambridge, where Phil and Dick were from, and Al and I got to interview Son House, and he told us a lot about himself, about his relationship to Charlie Patton.
So who else were you able to, meet and see in person? I know we really can't scratch the surface on that. I'm sure you met a lot of really, really interesting people.
Of the famous ones, the rediscoveries and all that,
mm-hmm.
White, Son House, Mississippi John Hurt, I didn't really get to know him. I talked with him. Skip James, got to know him pretty well. He stayed with me. Fred McDowell, Robert P. Williams, they were on the circuit. They were discovered by other folklorists, Alan Lomax and Harry Oster. So I got to see, people like Lytton Hopkins, Nance Lipscomb. I talk with him, but nothing special.
Nothing special. I mean, I think I know.
Skip James is, I knew pretty well. He gave me leads to people back in his hometown in Bentonia, Mississippi.
Wow. So is that mostly how you did your research? Just kind of, talking to these different people and...
Leads.
Leads.
From one musician to another. I was interested in the connections between musicians.
Sure.
I wasn't just randomly looking for blues artists. I mean, another way to do research and find great musicians. George Mitchell more or less did that and found all sorts of great country blues artists. I was more specifically looking for ones that had connections to each other.
So one of the people you mentioned you met was Robert Pete Williams. And I don't really know a whole lot about him, but I saw in the book Pioneers of the Blues Revival by Steve Cushing, there's a really cool picture of you with him. Can you talk a little bit about meeting him and what his backstory was?
Robert Pete, he was from Louisiana. He grew up outside Baton Rouge. He started playing blues, I guess, in the maybe late 20s or so, early 30s, and on into the 40s, just pretty much locally. He was a very creative kind of artist. He could make up songs spontaneously, kind of like John Lee Hooker and Lightnin' Hopkins. Had a very distinctive style. I don't know what his personality was like in his early days. The fact is he got in trouble with the law. He killed a man in a barroom fight. He says it was self-defense, but everybody spoke against him. He went to prison, the long and short of it, in Angola, a penitentiary. And Harry Oster found him there doing research in the late 50s. Harry was a kind of mild-mannered English professor who wanted to be a folklorist, and John and Alan Lomax were his model. You know, they had gone and found Lead Belly in Angola,
right,
in 1933, playing his 12-string guitar there. And, you know, the story of Lead Belly then getting free from prison and having a career. So Harry Oster wanted to do the same thing. He took a tape recorder and a 12-string guitar to Angola, and sure enough, he found Robert Pete Williams.
That's funny.
There and some other good blues artists, and recorded them, and he helped Robert Pete get out.
Wow.
Robert Pete started doing concerts and visited me and my girlfriend and partner, you know, Marina Volkelman, in California in 1966 on one of his first tours outside of Louisiana. In fact, I think he was still on some kind of parole. You know, first time he had seen mountains, first time he'd seen the ocean. And he stayed with us, you know, for about a week, interviewed him, and then later that year, we made a field expedition to Louisiana, Mississippi, and stayed with him for about a week. He had a long and fairly successful career, I think, until the early 90s, toured Europe a number of times. I mean, this was a man that
Wow.
was illiterate. He was an ex-con. He had a lot of strikes against him.
Yeah.
You know, he made, oh gosh, about a dozen albums and tours, and started a little scrap metal business with his sons. He was a real example of rehabilitation, you might say.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for Robert Pete Williams. He was quite a person and a great artist, great musician, very sensitive guy.
So besides just being a fan of the blues yourself, to put it mildly, you're an accomplished musician in your own right. Can you describe kind of the feeling of being able to perform and showcase some of the music that is such a huge part of your life?
Well, when you like a type of music, you get attracted to it, as I did in the early 60s, to blues. You often want to do it all. You want to collect all the recordings, hear it all, see the music live, meet the musicians, and play. Perform the music.
Absolutely.
That was me. You know, I wanted to do it all. I didn't want to play along with people. I didn't record myself with other artists, except a few times, like if it was, say, an old blues violin player that didn't have a guitarist, you know, and needed somebody, or mm-hmm. a harmonica player that needed a guitar accompanist, I would fill in. But basically, you know, I would watch and listen, and you get a mental image and sound ringing in your head, and then you go off and try to do it.
Well, David, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to answer some of my questions.
Sure, glad to, and you take care anytime.
I appreciate it.